Welcome to the She Wore Black podcast. I'm Agatha Andrews. Today, I have Dr. Brandi Scalacci on to chat about their fascinating life as a macabre researcher, autism, and their charming new mystery novel, The Framed Women of Ardmore House. We discuss the gruesome nonfiction novels they are known for, authentic representation of the autistic experience, and their appearances on History Channel shows as an expert on strange history. I have Dr. Scalacci's books in my bookshop if you want to support both the podcast as well as independent bookstores nationwide. That's at bookshop.org/shop/SheWoreBlack. If you want another way to help out my show, you can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and leave me a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can also join my Patreon community, buy merch, or make a coffee donation through the links available on my website at SheWoreBlackPodcast.com. Thanks for joining me today. Now, on to the show. Well, Dr. Brandi Scalacci, I am so excited to have you on She Wore Black today. Not only did you write one of the most adorable mysteries I've read in recent history, but you have this incredible, fabulous background. Can you please introduce yourself, and then we'll introduce the book to our listeners?
Yes, thank you for having me on. So my name is Brandi Scalacci, and I am autistic. I am, I'm very neurodivergent. I'm also someone who grew up with in abandoned coal territory. So abandoned coal lands, lived in an underground house next to a cemetery, had a pet raccoon. There were snakes in the ceiling. You know, I've had a very interesting life as far as my growing up years. Also, I have a PhD. I'm a historian, and I do a lot of nonfiction. So my nonfiction requires me to do all kinds of research. I've been to Berlin, I've been to Moscow, I've been to the Paris catacombs. So most of the time I'm digging around and doing history, you know, getting my hands dirty with things. And this is my first mystery novel, but it's not the first time I've encountered mystery. It's just usually the mysteries I encounter are true.
I love that way of thinking about it. I love that way of thinking about how, like, the questions you want to answer with your nonfiction is like it's solving a mystery. I had never thought about that.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah, it definitely is. One of my books was about the history of head transplants. There was a head transplant done to primate monkeys, and a successful head transplant in the 1970s that nobody knows about. I found out about it, and I was like, well, I must go on a quest about this, because that's weird enough to people should know about this.
And that's Mr. Humble and Dr. Butcher?
It is. Yeah. Those were the two nicknames of the doctor. He also was nominated for a Nobel Prize. He wasn't as much as you might think he was a Frankenstein figure, he was also a well-known and well-respected surgeon. So you just never know what you're going to find out in history.
Okay. So there's a lot of wonderful things to unpack. Living underground next to a cemetery is interesting.
It is. You know, you live at the same level as the dead people, and they make actually very quiet neighbors.
Yeah. I guess so.
No loud parties at all.
Oh, man. And then, okay, so you've also written something called A Death Summer Coat, What Death and Dying Teach Us About Life and Living.
Yeah.
You've been on a TED Talk to talk about the science of steampunk. Like, you've got a range, and it's all my target audience. So if you want to tell us a little bit of background with your nonfiction, y'all, sure. She has been on Mysteries of the Museum. Aren't you on, and didn't you tell me that you're on another History Channel
show? Yeah, History Channel show with Dan Aykroyd, The Unbelievable. I'm on that one as well. And they're getting a second season, which is great. I actually run a show myself, a Peculiar Book Club, which is all, I had trouble finding out, like, where's the hub of people who like the weird stuff that I like, you know, like, where's the intersection for sort of neuroatypical,
right,
history buff, weird gothic people. And I couldn't find one. So I made one. So the Peculiar Book Club is a nonfiction book club rather than we do some mystery books because I have intersections there too, but largely it's nonfiction. And it's very much, what are my interests? And it turns out there's lots of other people. I bet I'm shaking hands with your audience right now. Like, we could be weird together, guys. Like, this is right and good. Because you know, you grow up thinking, yeah, I'm a big weirdo, right? And you're told you're weird, or don't be weird. I heard that as a mantra from my parents. It was like, please don't be weird in public. But yeah, which just comes naturally to me. Like, I'm a bit odd, but you can't help it. Like I'm neurodivergent. I live sort of, and my brain is put together a little strange, but then you see things around you just a little differently. Kind of, it's like seeing around corners, right? You just aren't looking at it with quite the same eyes as everyone else. So, which is exciting. I mean, it makes life interesting. I think I live at the intersections, and that's exciting.
Well, listen, you're speaking absolutely to a fan base that's built in for you, because Gothic and horror fans are definitely this audience of people who are going to want to know the dark and macabre things, because they write about them too. They may interject like something supernatural, but you know, they're certainly going to have an interest in cemeteries and weird surgeries and
I've been to so many
body
cemeteries
horror and you know all kinds of things.
I've been in cemeteries in lots of other countries too, and like Père Lachaise in Paris and the catacombs, which were just, that's a neat place. That's a different place, and it's damp and it smells like death. And I was like, I don't know why I'm surprised, but it does. It smells like death. It should. So, but yeah, I taught Gothic literature actually. I'm a recovering academic, I guess you'd say. I absconded, but I was a professor. I taught Gothic literature. I taught Frankenstein a lot. I'm a medical humanities person, so I did a lot of intersections of like Gothic literature and real science that it was sometimes based on, and sometimes real science way weirder than the stuff we come up with in fiction.
Yeah.
You'll read about stuff and think, roasted raven's heart was an actual supposed cure for epilepsy, just to give an example. So, you know, there's some very, very weird things that I just happen to know in my brain. And writing about that in fiction, creating a character who can be that repository of bizarre information, you know, it was so much fun. It was just so much fun.
Well, yeah, I want to get into the book, and I want to get into like the difference of writing. I love that you talked about nonfiction as sort of solving its own mystery, and that you're also speaking from a place, not just as a historian, but as someone who taught Gothic literature.
Yeah.
Like, you have all the things for my listeners.
Hi, listeners. I will be all the things for you today.
And so, well, I think that's really exciting. What prompted you to write mystery?
Okay, guys, you're gonna really like this story. All right, so I can't give you the full story because I don't want to give anything away in the book, but the book seed, the seed of this book that grew into the tree that is this book, came from something I actually did find out about. So I've spent quite a lot of time in Europe, and particularly in England, parts of the UK. I lived over there for a time doing research and some other stuff. I'd had a residency there. So I found out, if you're not familiar, they have the Gardens of the National Trust in England. And it's where they will take over big estate gardens and things that are no longer, that, you know, there's not an aristocracy to support them anymore. They don't have the money. And these gardens are amazing and they're beautiful. And they're, you know, in areas of outstanding national beauty, and they're on registries. And I happen to be a big fan. And I watched these old BBC gardening shows all the time. And one of them was taking a tour through the these very National Trust gardens. And one of the gardens is supposed to be haunted.
Ooh.
Yeah. So what happened is, as they were reconstructing the gardens, they found something. And I can't tell you what that is, but they found something. And I thought, that is macabre as anything. That I need to wrap a story around that. So that's partly where the seed for the mystery came from. So there's a reason there's a lot of Gothic elements in the book. But in addition to that, I myself spent a lot of time as an American living in Britain. And it's a you know, that fish out of water kind of, where it's almost the same, but not quite the same. And of course, I miss social cues as it is, folks. So, you know, I was just kind of thrust into these situations where I was going to be misunderstood. And I thought, what a fun, you know, way of talking about mystery is to also have someone for whom the very surrounding that they're putting themselves into is brand new. And I think I've seen that done in fiction before. I really like it. And so I thought I would take that angle.
Excellent. Well, let's back up and let our listeners know what The Framed Women of Ardenmore House is all about.
Oh, sure. So it starts off with a character named Jo Jones. Now, Jo is in her mid-30s to late 30s. She's on her way to her late 30s. She is neurodivergent. She has autism. She was a book editor, and she's hyperlexic, as am I. So that if you don't know what that is, it's usually diagnosed in youth, where you read really early and have command of or mastery of language very early. As an adult, it means I'm a speed reader. I tend not to forget the things that I have read. So it's not quite like a photo. It's like a photographic memory with a slow shutter speed. That's probably a good way of thinking about it. So anyway, this is Jo. When she enters the story, she's had a really rotten year. She's gotten divorced. She loses her job in the divorce in a complicated kind of because he's a bad person way. Her mother has passed away. And in the middle of grieving for all of that, the will is read, and she finds out that she's inherited this property from a family she knows nothing about because she thought she was the last person left alive in her family. She has no idea about this British connection. So she basically is like, well, I don't have anything to lose, right? So she launches herself, and the book opens as she is approaching the property for the first time in this Gothic landscape. It's very Bronte. It's very, you know, there's moors. And the property is an absolute disrepair. Like it sounds like, oh, it's a dream come true. And then she gets there and it's like, no, it's not. It's got back taxes and there's a hole in the roof and it's raining and there might be rats. But she's willing to make a go of it. She's a very unsinkable character. She's like, daggone it, I'm going to restart myself, you know, right here. Immediately finds a mysterious room that has a mysterious painting in it that doesn't make any sense, isn't supposed to be there. No one knows about it. The painting vanishes. And a day later, there's a dead body on the carpet. So her time, she's there for like 2 days and all of these things happen. And unfortunately, she's the new person in town. So she becomes suspect number one.
Well, I mean, this was just such a joy. I wasn't real sure what I was getting into because everything I had seen from you was nonfiction before. So I was like, what's this going to be? You know, and I had a great time. I listened to this on the road and I have the book. And so I was kind of going back and forth between written. And your narrator, by the way, is excellent.
She does all the accents.
All of them.
And there are so many.
So many accents.
There's an Irish, Welsh, you know?
Yes. British, American, like
Newcastle.
Yeah.
Dialect. There's dialect in there. I'm sure she hated me on some occasions.
Well, it was fun in both formats for sure. And I have to say, this is important to me as the mother of an autistic child. I really appreciated that this is an autistic main character written by an autistic author. Mm-hmm. Jo was nuanced and relatable in a way that I've not seen in some very popular novels that center autistic characters where the authors were not themselves on the spectrum. And so regardless of their good intentions and their interest in representation, they inevitably accidentally create stereotypes or cartoons instead of an authentic experience. So was this on your mind as you wrote Jo? The main character.
It was. So it's an interesting story to tell here is that the very first time I took a crack at the novel, I didn't mean to make Jo autistic like myself, but it happened anyway. And then I think it was my agent or someone was like, so she's autistic, right? And I was like, no. Yeah, she is. But but the exciting thing is I thought I was going to be asked to weed that out. And instead, my editor just kept asking me for more. Like, could you make her more autistic? And I thought to myself, never in the history of my life has anyone asked me to be more autistic. Like less? Yes, I've heard less. But, you know, it was like, be free. And in fact, what was wonderful about this is Jo Jones becomes part of my own journey because I was a late diagnosis. We knew, but there was a lot of stigma. I'm Gen X. And my parents didn't want to, you know, load stigma on top of, you know, there's various reasons I didn't get tested. But so this has been part of like a almost coming out journey for me of being honest with people about what's really going on and how much of what I'm doing is masking to try and fit in. And so to have a character who was allowed and encouraged to be unmasked, to be herself and to make that part of what she's trying to do in this new community. It's not really a spoiler because you get told this very early on, but her husband was constantly trying to like repackage her ex-husband, in a masked non-autistic way. And so she's like living free for the first time. And that was freeing for me as an author. But the other thing that was so important to me is like, being autistic is not the most important thing about me. It's not the most interesting thing about me. And I hate it when you read characters who it's like, that's the autistic one, you know? Yes. I wanted that to just be something about her, like being a brunette. Right. And that she would go through, like, you know, you got this unique experience, but not because she's a superhero or because I didn't want to play either spectrum. She's not completely unable to function, but she's also not a superhero, right? It's this balance of just being human and having a unique perspective on the world, because that representation really matters.
Yeah. I mean, I'm Latina, and I know that there are times where I feel, or I've been pressured, or other authors like me have been pressured to like insert things that we wouldn't ordinarily do just because it reads to a white audience, this is Latina, you know, whereas for you, you're probably like,
right,
well, how can this read as autistic to a neurotypical audience with expectations of what autism looks like? And that's what authors that are not on the spectrum, that are trying to write empathetic characters, inevitably wind up doing, and why it can actually be harmful. I was invited to be on a trope last year. The Horror Writers Association has a conference every year called StokerCon, where they give their awards and stuff, but they also do a lot of panels. And I was invited to be on a panel of tropes, and Brian McCauley hosted that, and he said, what trope do you want to see die? And my trope that I want to see die are the non-speaking characters as the things to be feared in novels, because I feel like, you know, non-speaking folks on the spectrum already face, you know, enough prejudice and enough problems where they don't need that compounding it.
Right.
You know, and so I was just really enjoying your book because I felt like you were doing what I want to do with my work, which is just exist without explaining everything or without like it felt authentic. You can tell when something feels authentic.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt like you really accomplished that.
Well, and it was a strength too. So many, I know a lot of people have talked about this, like, right, you watch the Sherlock, BBC Sherlock, and you can diagnose the characters, but the characters themselves don't own any of those diagnoses. And I wanted to provide my character the space to name herself and to say, I am this. And then that becomes its own. I don't have to give you cues. She's told you, you know, it's a little bit like, there for a while, it seemed like, so I'm also, spicy on the queer spectrum as well. And, one of the things there for a while is every queer character seemed to have blue hair. Like if you watch TV, it's like, oh, blue hair. So she must be, you know, it's like, that's not how we all are. I'm both non-binary and bisexual, but that's partly because I don't understand gender. I think that that's true of many people who are neurodivergent as well. We're like, boxes,
right?
What boxes? So yeah, I totally get that, and I hear what you're saying about the non-speaking characters too, because I hear a lot of I do some work in social justice for disability. And for facial difference, there's a lot of that too. People talking about, like, you have every Bond villain has to have a facial scar or something. And that same sort of expectation. I actually prefer my villains to be pretty hard to pick out.
Well, okay. So something you did that I thought was fun is that, okay, so you didn't just write, like, you were talking about boxes. What boxes? I love that you compounded her experience. You know, not just, she's not just a neurodivergent person. She's like an American in England. Like that in and of itself is already like, well, something.
Yeah.
Like the others, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And everyone kind of is like, is she like, okay. I have literally been asked this before. People be like, are you like this because you're American? And I'm like, I don't know what that question means.
I understand. We get that from Texas too. You know, like, is this a Texas thing? Yeah, we get that too. So, oh my goodness. Well, one thing I loved about your book and you as the author is that the very fact that you're writing a book with a deep understanding of each and every character, and writing a book in which every character is interesting and every character is funny, or, you know, like they all have nuance and quirks. I love it. Your ability to write this flies in the face of the stereotype that autistic people don't have empathy or understand emotion. Like, your ability to write these characters that way already just like shows that that's garbage.
Yeah.
Your book is full of nuance. It's full of humor. It's full of love for the characters that you've written. And mysteries are often just like plot driven, but you wrote a mystery that's as character driven as the plot. And I didn't know if you wanted to speak to all of that.
Sure. Well, I think some of it is, so I should say, again, I'm a historian, right? So you read history and you live in the world, and I've had to kind of come up to speed on things. And so I feel like I've made human nature a personal study in some ways, partly because you are asked to mask, you are asked to join in or ape certain behaviors. And so you get really good at recognizing them, and you get really good, because you miss social cues, you get really good at paying almost too much attention to body language, but then it becomes very useful. And so with the breadth of history that I've read, and you know, history is full of very quirky people. You don't even have to make them up. Like, they're just there. And for me, I wanted the experience of this book to include everyone. I wanted there to be something for everyone to enjoy and to take part in this book. And so you've got the Welsh antiques dealer with ADHD who looks a little bit like Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. And then you've got, you know, the Irish innkeeper who refuses to get married or change her name and has a much younger, you know, fella that everyone is like sort of mad about. And you just, you know, you have there's just so many people that you want to kind of engage and get to know. I've lived in little villages. Like, they're full of interesting people, like, not a homogenous group, really. You go to these places.
Yeah.
And I wanted to reflect that, but I also wanted the story to have like a plot. Well, it's really got kind of two plots. You have this, Joe is trying to find something out about a missing painting in her family. And also someone is dead. So we also have kind of a police procedural mixed in there too.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit, because you wrote a novel that plays in the sandbox of like a British cozy mystery, but you tweak things enough to offer something fresh and new. Joe inherits the crumbling British manor, but she's more interested in finding out about the missing painting, yeah, her family history, than she is in solving the murder of, yeah, the person she found in her house. So, and then I like chuckled out loud when she calls the police officer to say that she's headed to Swansea. And he's like, we're in the middle of a murder investigation. You're not really supposed to be leaving.
So, yeah, she just up and goes to Swan. And by the way, so Americans, we have a big country. The UK is like the size of Pennsylvania. So it doesn't occur to us not to just hop and go someplace that's hours away, but they don't do that there. I drove once from London to over towards the Lakes District, and people acted like I had, you know, gone to Russia. So part of it is that she's just not used to thinking about it that way. But the other thing is, she's from New York. Like, she's from Brooklyn. People get murdered. She's kind of like, I have other things to do. And that doesn't play well. You know, the police are just trying to figure out, like, is she the villain? Like, who is she?
Well, and I love how he's just kind of like, well, okay, you know, what else can you do?
He can't quite get his head around her. Like, he doesn't quite know. He's a little bit beside himself. Anyway, I really like the detective figure for all of his faults. You know, he's also a divorcee, though not a recent divorcee, but clearly not as over it as Joe. And you get this kind of sense that he's just a little bit out of water himself, even though he's grown up in this town.
Yeah. Well, and then this all goes back to the idea of what you had just said about how you almost have two stories. I mean, it is clearly a mystery novel, but yeah, there are two sort of things going on. And I just thought, well, this is enough of a fun, fresh twist, you know, like something, it's going to be something people aren't expecting, and it's going to be a good time for them.
I think we actually made it onto a thriller list as well. And I was quite surprised, but I was like, yeah. I was like, hey, I'll take it, you know, because I don't fit in boxes, neither does the book. Surprise.
I love it. I feel like the cover is also really cute though, and it does a good job of capturing the atmosphere and like what to expect as far as like the mood and the setting and everything. Mm-hmm, like it does a really good job. I love this cover. Well, something that I found interesting is how you maintained the charm and cozy atmosphere of historical cozy mysteries, but it's a contemporary story. Your characters use cell phones, they use the internet. And I know this is actually something that authors really worry about. And so what they inevitably do is they either go all in on technology where everything is like super tech, or they just stick it in a historical setting like 1990s or earlier, like you know, all the way historical, just to avoid dealing with technology. So how do you think, like, were you able or intentionally trying to strike a balance between like what we know of fun, cozy historicals and modern technology? Because I didn't feel taken out of by the use of technology.
I'm a big fan of cozies. And one of the things I tend to like, I'm a huge fan also of BBC Mystery and some shows which I think count as cozies really, handle this really well. Queens of Mystery is a good example that you have, there's cell phones, there's technology, but the technology, it's not CSI, you know, there's a lot of paper and pens involved.
That's my world.
It's analog. So the funny thing is I actually write them longhand. I write my books longhand with a fountain pen. On notebooks, usually takes 3 notebooks. Actually, I have them right here. I know they can't see me, but you can. So
that's so cool. Like they have book. Hardcover spot. Like
yeah, they do. there's plenty of that. Midsummer Murders is another one that's clearly a cozy in nature or Rosemary in Time, but yet there's aspect of technology. And so I took some cues from the television world because I thought they handled that really well. But the other thing that is true, I grew up in I told you about the underground house thing. You can have technology and still not be able to use technology very well.
Yeah.
Where I lived, there was no cell phone reception. And so I was able to play with that. Like at times where it matters in the text or where it's useful in the text, you know, there's not good coverage. So it's not that technology can't always save you or can't always save the day, but it can exist and bring those two worlds together.
Now, is this going to be a series?
It is. I just finished the sequel.
Ooh, do we get a title on that?
I don't have a title yet. I had a title in mind and then I found out it was already used.
Oh, man.
So now I know. So I'm working on it with my editor. But yes, the second one is going to come out next. So not this summer, but next summer or next spring anyway, around then. And it's, I literally sent it like a week ago.
Well, I mean, I know authors don't like to look at their Goodreads reviews, but I was on Goodreads and everybody was like, I hope there's another one because like, and they were trying not to give spoilers as to why they hope there's another one, but they're like, but we need another one.
I get a lot. I get a specific question repeatedly and it's a where question. It's a where's the, and I can't tell you what that question is without spoilers, but
right.
I promise there's an answer in book two.
Oh my goodness. Well, I love that. I love that you've left fans wanting more. That's the way that you want to do it with a fiction novel.
Yeah, it's true. Especially when like this, the characters are so interesting in and of themselves. And each subsequent, well, I don't know if there will be, so I know there's going to be a sequel. Hopefully there'll be more, but I want to expand the characters individually. So for instance, you learn more about Tula. Who is the innkeeper in the sequel. So there's so many interesting characters that you can actually just keep kind of expanding. It's like a Russian doll, you know, you just keep taking it apart and there's just more to see.
Well, that's okay. So that really helps when you're reading it, because like I said, all of your characters are interesting or funny or what they bring something to the table that the book wouldn't feel complete without. And they're all so charming in their weird little ways. Like they're all like, the sisters, I mean, they're bonkers.
Yeah, then we have the sister wives. The sister wives are an interesting set of characters. People ask me about them a lot. Roberta Wilkinson, the very cranky innkeeper who may or may not be based on an old English teacher of mine. Who
we
hits
will
the
not
ground with her stick.
Confirm or deny.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Welsh. I love, there's actually more than one neurodivergent character in the book. The Welsh antiques dealer who is younger than Joe, but immediately sort of smitten with her. There's an interesting sort of, there's no romance. There's all the romance. It's things are happening, folks, if you like that. I try to make sure that it I want it to feel true. I mean, she's someone who's just gotten out of a divorce. She's not looking to
she's
trying to get free.
Well, I want to get back, if you don't mind. I didn't want to fully leave like Mysteries at the Museum behind us.
Right.
If you don't, can we go back to that? Because that was my fiction set of questions, because the thing is, I don't want to talk too much about the novel because I don't want to give things away. And it's so easy to do that. But I do. I mean, you're just such a fascinating person. I'm like, she's done all the things.
Done all the things. It's true. Mysteries at the Museum happened because I used to work in a medical history museum. And so I have seen a lot of things. We were a technology museum. So that meant it wasn't like body parts in jars. It was bone saws and, various early x-ray equipment and early anesthesia equipment and really horrifying things, actually.
Yeah.
You look at that and go, wow, no, I wouldn't want that put in there. Tooth extraction tools, all kinds of stuff. We also had a huge collection of historical books, and the historical books were, some of them went all the way back to kind of woodcut kind of things that were really, really old. And there was a big collection of dermatology, and dermatology in the present day kind of freaks me out. Like if you go online and Google dermatological images, you never know what you're going to get. It was worse. So you're looking at a 19th century fully color rendered, painted, illustrated book, and you just sort of like turn a page and end up like, oh, that's some syphilitic genitalia, interesting. And you just don't know what you're gonna get. That's some smallpox, sure, there's some, leprosy, that looks great. So yeah, I saw some stuff. I used to give demonstrations when we would have school groups come in, and I used to give demonstrations on how to remove a leg while someone was still awake.
Volunteers, anyone?
Volunteers. Oh, they always volunteer. Someone always wanted to be the victim. Like, strangely, there was a lot of people being like, oh, take my leg off. So, but it was a lot of fun. And I did that for a number of years. I ended up on the hunt for the mechanical woman. In the 18th century, they switched from female midwives to man midwives. Men were basically trying to take over this job. But how exactly do you practice? So they would go to a school for 6 weeks and then they'd get a certificate. Now, how are you going to go practice delivering a baby? Like, you've not done this before. So they built a mechanical woman, essentially. Of course they did. And it was quite impressive, I guess, had sort of flexible skin and all kinds of stuff. And it was operated by levers. It gave birth once an hour. It didn't have a head. So it was a perfect woman for the 18th century, I suppose. They talked about the doctors as being the men were in labor, bringing the, like, as though they were the ones doing the hard work, right? So I went on a hunt to try and find this thing, and I ended up in this amateur collector's basement vault. And
as you do,
right, in the countryside, like, no one know. I'm sitting, you've driven for an hour into the countryside, and now you're going to someone's basement vault, and like at some point a little bell goes off in your head going, if this were a novel, this would be a really bad idea. So I walk downstairs, and it's got a big, like a big bank vault door. So we walk inside, and he shuts it behind us, and he's keying it back together. And he's like, don't worry, if we get trapped in here, there's 3 days of air. And I just looking around at medical equipment going, this is the worst idea I've ever had. Why am I here?
That's not reassuring.
No, not at all. And no, we didn't get locked in, thankfully. I got out, I had pizza, it was fine. But You, as a medical historian, you encounter stuff, and as a result, people like the Mysteries of the Museum call you up and go, could you be on our show and talk about the first man who catheterized his own heart? And I'm like, sure.
Okay. But that's amazing. That is amazing. Oh my gosh. Well, now we're going to have to go look up all your episodes. I know one thing that I will do, listeners. I know that y'all know that I have a bookshop, and what I will do in my show notes and in my bookshop is have links to all of these wonderful nonfiction books that Brandy's written. And then I'm going to see if I can dig up dig up some clips. If I can't dig up clips, I'm apologizing, but I'm going to try.
Well, I will say that it is easier to get the ones that I've recently done. I have trouble finding the clips of Mysteries at the Museum, but the Dan Aykroyd show, aired about a month ago. And I think I'm on episodes 8, 10, and 12 or 8, 10, it's up in the second half of the season. I'm talking about vampires at one point. Not real ones.
That's amazing that Dan Aykroyd's doing this too. It's
it's fun. Yeah, it's basically like things that are real. That so there was the vampire outbreak of Chesky Kromlov in the 18th century, and essentially it was not vampires, but people thought it was a vampire plague. They thought that people were catching vampirism. So they did horrible desecrating things to graves. So yeah, that's the kind of stuff that I get called to go talk about on television.
You're so cool.
Yeah, you know, something about that living underground when you're a young person just puts you on a path and there's just nothing you can do about it.
You're the coolest. Oh my gosh. I love all of these stories. So I'm going to go dig them up. Dig them up. Put them.
Dig them up. Dig them up, right? Next to the cemetery. It's all appropriate.
Well, what an absolute treat it has been to have you on my show. Thank you so much for coming on. I know that it will delight all my listeners, and I can't wait to dive into all of your nonfiction and see what the sequel is all about. I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for joining me today on She Wore Black. If you like what you heard and want to support my work on the show, you can visit my website at sheworeblackpodcast.com for links to my Patreon, my coffee donation site, as well as my merch and my online bookshop. You can also help out the show by rating me on Apple and following me on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads, and letting your friends know about the show. Thanks for joining me today, and happy reading.